Chapter 4. Damned If You Do. Even in the face of the aforementioned traps that can hold women back, the Goldilocks conundrum of being too strong or too warm, and the calls for authenticity and likability that can feel as though they do not apply to all of us, you have likely chosen to pursue success anyway. Thank goodness. And yet, the pursuit of that success and the realization of it is a trap itself. Professional women who make the elusive climb to the top, even those who just look like they're making it to the top, will run into the success penalty. The success penalty. As a woman, the more successful you become, the less others will like you. Just because. Whether you get there by being warm or strong, being successful becomes a new demerit. Plus, the very actions ordinarily deemed necessary to attain professional success, seeking power, advocating for oneself, even having exceptional grades, will decrease your likability. Here's where the calculation gets really complicated. Women, like most people, are taught that in order to be successful, they need to be well-liked. So if we have established that women can't be both successful and well-liked, but they need to be well-liked in order to be successful, is the conclusion that a woman can never be successful? We know that can't be true. Condoleezza Rice, Angela Merkel, and Sheryl Sandberg, am I right? But there's a reason we all know their names. There are so few of them who have reached the tippity top of their respective fields. Being a woman who is both successful and well-liked is the professional equivalent of landing a triple axel. Possible, but improbable. So you, mere mortal, choose. Be considered competent and successful, or be well-liked. The woman who chooses success thinks, "This is the first line in my obituary." The woman who chooses likability thinks, "Yes, but how many people will be at your funeral?" Of all the choices, false and otherwise, that confront a professional woman, this one, the supposed choice between likability and success, on the surface, has an easy answer. Choose success. As Fran Rogers told me, if you're going to spend all these hours working, why wouldn't you want to be successful? You want to end up with some asshole boss who used to be your peer but just played the game better? Choose success. Choose it every time because even though it is not guaranteed, it is nearly impossible to attain without striving for. And likability is impossible to guarantee. If only it were that simple. In truth, there isn't a one-time existential decision between ambition and likability, like picking door number one or door number two. Behind the door of success is more doors, lots of doors, a series of micro-choices that women have to make every single day to uncertain effect. And it turns out the doorknobs might be electrified. For example, the path to success for most people requires self-advocacy and convincing others that they are worthy of investment. So do I, in the spirit of self-advocacy that is so important to my success, question my boss's feedback, knowing he might like me less if I do? Perhaps I do if I've chosen to speed down the path of ambition and won't let a likability bump stand in the way. But what if offending my boss before a performance review actually threatens the opportunity for a raise or a promotion? This is where it becomes important to know that there is more than one success penalty. There is a success penalty that is incurred when you become successful. But there is another, more challenging success penalty, the one that starts taking its toll the moment you start even trying to be successful. It's not simply that a woman becomes less likable when she takes the throne. She seems less likable merely for eyeing it, and is penalized for doing nearly every single thing that is required to get there. Consider the case of Heidi and Howard Roizen. While teaching at Columbia Business School, Professor Frank Flynn presented to his students a case study about Heidi Roizen, a successful entrepreneur and venture capitalist. The study detailed Heidi's experience, as well as the professional challenges she faced. One section of the class received the original case, as I just described it. For another section of the class, Flynn altered one detail of the study. He changed Heidi's name to Howard and altered the pronouns accordingly. He then asked his students to rate Heidi Roizen or Howard Roizen. Students who thought Roizen was a woman judged her harshly. Although they think she's just as competent and effective as Howard, they don't like her, they wouldn't hire her, and they wouldn't want to work with her, Flynn explains. Among her demerits, assertiveness, lack of humility, self-promotion, and ambition. In contrast, people liked Howard just fine. When Sheryl Sandberg brought Heidi, Howard, and the idea of the success like ability penalty to the masses in her 2010 TED Talk, and later in her book, Lean In, a wave of essays and studies followed questioning how real the penalty was. While I appreciate those who challenge conventional wisdom, there are also some things that you watch happen enough over your 30-something years of life that you have to wonder if you really need social science to back it up. As my manager, Josanne, likes to say, I don't need facts. I have instincts. I may not be an academic or a practitioner, but as a woman in the world, this feels pretty obvious to me. Has anyone ever suggested to a woman that a great way to make friends is to be more ambitious? Has anyone offered success to women as a pathway to likability? It wasn't just Heidi Roizen's success that made people judge her. It was an underlying belief that the things she did to become successful were somehow wrong. Most of the discourse around likability and women in the workplace focuses on women at the very top. But likability plagues us from day one. In order to get a job, people need to like you. Once you get a job, you want to make a good impression. That can mean feeling pressure to go along with things you know are bad ideas, doing others' work and covering for them, or even just rapidly responding to emails for fear of being perceived as lazy. And then, if you don't want to get stuck in your entry-level job forever, you have to make sure that people know your accomplishments without sounding arrogant. And you've got to negotiate to get more responsibility and more money without seeming entitled. You have to receive feedback graciously, and once you're a manager, give it constructively without alienating the people you manage. At every single step, likability and self-efficacy are in conflict. Getting the job. You are the definition of under-promise and over-deliver, Lauren, my friend, tells me. I didn't wow her the first time we met. I'm just not that kind of person. As someone who doesn't make a great first impression, I find job interviews to be the absolute worst. It's a delicate dance that requires Misty Copeland levels of footwork, not the 3 years of jazz at Union City, New Jersey's Hollywood School of Dance that I possess. Women are told to be enthusiastic without seeming like a tart, show interest without seeming desperate, talk about what they bring to the table without sounding like they're bragging, all the while knowing that their performance in that moment will open or close doors. No pressure. This is an especially difficult challenge for women who are pursuing leadership roles. When a man walks into an interview, the interviewer presumes he's competent. When a woman walks in, she has to prove it. To demonstrate your competence, you have to show confidence and ambition while taking great care not to allow your competence to overshadow your warmth. Oh, and be good, but not too good. When competent women apply for a job, very often the hiring criteria actually shift away from core competencies to judgments about the applicant's social skills. Rather than focus on what she does bring to the table, such as experience or an ability to get the job done, employers focus instead on what they perceive to be her deficit. In one study led by Natasha Quadlin, the researcher sent out applications from a mix of men and women with different grade point averages. For male applicants, the GPA didn't seem to matter. Men with low GPAs received about the same number of callbacks as men with high GPAs. For women, GPAs mattered a lot, but not in the way you might expect. Women applicants benefited from moderate achievement, but not high achievement. women applicants with mid-level GPAs received more calls than both lower and higher achieving women. Male applicants with high GPAs were nearly twice as likely as their female peers to get follow-up calls. College majors mattered too. Among math majors, male applicants with high GPAs were 3 times as likely to receive follow-up. That's particularly upsetting when you think of the gender gap in STEM fields. There is a hiring penalty for high-achieving women. But why? Quadlin followed up with a study asking would-be employers to rate resumes for several traits, including likability and competence. When evaluating a high-achieving woman, respondents placed a premium on her likability. Respondents were more than twice as likely to highlight a high-achieving applicant's likability when she was a woman. Respondents seemed to love moderate-achieving women. According to Quadlin, their comments suggest that when women have moderate achievement, they are perceived as competent enough, but not the most competent, which allows them to be perceived as more likable than women with higher grades. Bet you're glad you skipped all those college parties to make study guides. You can imagine the assumptions that are made about academically high-achieving women. That their grades are an indication of their ambition, that they must be high-strung and no fun. It's the innuendo effect at play. All I know about her is that she's very high-achieving, so I am going to assume that she is less warm and thus less likable. Meanwhile, for all you know, that high-achieving girl was doing keg stands 5 minutes before she walked into the interview. Think about the time and energy that goes into properly applying for a job or preparing for a job interview. An impressive academic record, friends reading over and reformatting your resume, or CV if you're fancy, writing and rewriting your cover letter, agonizing over what you can wear that makes you look smart and cool and not like you borrowed your aunt's business suit. You want to prove you have what it takes to get the job, to jump a level, to be seen as a leader. Meanwhile, the very thing that has most likely brought you to this moment, your undeniable ability to do the job, is the same thing that risks tripping up your chance of landing it. Self-promotion. Does anyone feel like their boss knows or appreciates the full extent of what they do? I have friends who will document their workday via social media because they know that their managers follow them, and the timestamps are the only way to broadcast that they've worked for 12 straight hours. We can agree this is unhealthy and also agree that sometimes it's hard to know if your commitment and contributions fully register with your boss. Doing the work is important, but if no one knows that you did the work, then you run the risk of flying under the radar. To get ahead, you must take credit for your accomplishments. And in a world where few of us are putting in 30 years in one organization, you have to be able to articulate those accomplishments for people who have never worked with you but may want to. Taking credit is not instinctive for a lot of women. Getting over that is the first hurdle. As former Connecticut Governor Jody Rell told me, women just want to get the job done. That's what I think women bring to the table. We just want to get the work done. We don't care who gets the credit. While, when true, that collaborative spirit can lead to results and an expedited process, not taking credit ultimately limits who gets credit. For women, that means fewer people ascribe the success to you, and in turn, fewer people see you as the effective leader that you are. This is compounded by the fact the work doesn't always speak for itself. Often judgments about vision, leadership, and contribution are based on perceptions of whose vision, whose leadership, and whose contributions yielded the final product. Even once women can confidently self-promote, they face yet another penalty. They are judged for not being appropriately modest. And they pay a real price for that. They are considered less likable and less hireable. Negotiating backlash. In 2014, a woman identified as W claimed she was offered a tenure-track position as an assistant professor of philosophy at Nazareth College in Rochester, New York. Attempting to negotiate, W sent the university a list of counter requests, including a higher salary, a semester of maternity leave, a sabbatical, and class staffing parameters. In that email, she did many of the things a woman is encouraged to do when negotiating. She expressed her enthusiasm at the potential of working at the university and couched her requests by writing, "I know that some of these might be easier to grant than others. Let me know what you think." What the university did next shocked W. It rescinded its original offer. On the whole, these provisions indicate an interest in teaching at a research university and not at a college like ours that is both teaching and student-centered, the search committee responded. Thus, the institution has decided to withdraw its offer of employment to you. The university did not comment on the story, but it's more poetic than any fictionalized version of a negotiation I could write. A woman is offered a job, initiates negotiations, and then that job offer is taken away, cloaked in the explanation that the applicant's asks indicate a lack of fit with the institution's priorities. This story, hosted on the blog Philosophy Smoker, a popular site among philosophy student and young professor types, set off a debate. Many commenters were outraged on W's behalf, but others chafed at W's bravado. They called her requests unreasonable and argued that she had overplayed her hand. W paid a very real price for her negotiating. She lost a job offer. But she's not the only one to face blowback for initiating negotiations. Other women I spoke with who negotiated their compensation were told, often as soon as after their first counter, that perhaps they did not really want the job, or that maybe it wasn't a good fit. Even when they would ask for something as basic as a salary that matched their current salary, they were made to feel unreasonable. Negotiating can have big advantages. One study of more than 70,000 employees in corporate America found that women who negotiate and lobby for a promotion are more than twice as likely to get one. Here's something that might surprise you. Men report that they are less likely to ask for a raise. Why, pray tell? Because they are more likely to believe they currently receive fair compensation. Allow me to digress for a minute to tell you how much I hate asking for things. Much of my discomfort around asking is wrapped up in the asker versus guesser phenomenon. Askers ask for what they want and need. They will ask you to pick them up at the airport, babysit their kids, or borrow your nicest piece of jewelry. They'll ask regardless of whether you're their lifelong bestie or a coworker whom you've interacted with once. Part of the reason askers are so comfortable asking is that they are comfortable getting a no. If they want to sleep on your couch, they will say, "Hi, I'm coming into town on Thursday night. Can I sleep on your couch?" To an asker, the worst thing that can happen is that you'll decline their request. I am not an asker. I am on the other side of that continuum, a guesser. I hate to ask for anything. Whereas askers jump in without testing the waters, we guessers wait to ask until we're pretty sure the answer will be yes. In our perfect world, we'd be offered what we want without having to ask for it. So for me, a guesser, the same conversation, let's be honest, text exchange, about sleeping on someone's couch goes more like this. Me. Hey. Friend. Hey. Me. The weather, right? Friend, you're being weird. Me. So I'm going to be in town Thursday night. Friend. Oh, cool. Do you want to do something? Me. Yes, definitely. I'm still figuring out where to stay. Inside voice. Please offer your couch. Please offer your couch. Friend. Well, you're welcome to stay with me. Me. Inside. I've already put her out. She's being so polite. If she really meant it, there would have been an exclamation point at the end of that text. Really? That's not an imposition? Are you sure? Friend. It's fine. Me. Shit. Two texts with no exclamation points. You can totally tell me no. Friend, but I just told you yes. Me. Do you not use exclamation points? Maybe I should just stay at a hotel. Maybe you should just stay at a hotel. Also, consider therapy. You see, neurotic, painful. Part of the reason I and other guessers hate asking is that we don't feel that the individual on the other end of the ask really has the option of saying no. That is, in part, because when people ask us, the guessers, for things, we feel obligated to say yes. I have said yes to so many things I did not want to do. Hosting house guests, helping people move in 90-degree heat, even cat-sitting despite a deathly allergy. Because all of those painful things seemed less painful than saying no. All to say, I don't like asking for things for myself, but I do like money. So negotiating already poses an internal conflict. I know that I'm supposed to ask. I know the conventional wisdom on this. It never hurts to ask. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. It's as though every upwardly mobile woman is one ask away from doing the backstroke in her Scrooge McDuck-inspired gold coin pool. But shifting the negotiation gap back on women is overly simplistic. Women often pay a stiff social penalty for asking for what they want or need. Women who negotiate are more likely than men who negotiate, and women who don't, to receive feedback that they are intimidating, too aggressive, or bossy. Advocating for oneself, specifically for personal resources like a raise or a bonus, is a dominant act. And for women, that conflicts with the notion that they ought to be nice. And because women have long been considered to have less status than men, the mere act of saying, "Hey, I think I deserve what he has," can make a woman seem inappropriately demanding. For both violations, acting dominant and laying claim to equal privilege, women seem less likable. In contrast, when men ask for more, they pay no price. Men typically earn more than women, so it doesn't surprise employers when they ask to be paid more. In experiments around compensation negotiations, a group of researchers found that evaluators penalized women candidates more than men for initiating compensation negotiations. They were less likely to hire those women and less likely to want to work with them. A simulated salary negotiation study found that participants negotiating with an assertive woman were less likely to want to interact with her, in the office and outside of the office, than with men who asked in the exact same way. Just knowing that there is a high likelihood of backlash, of being less likable, women modulate their asks. In one study, men and women negotiated a starting salary with the understanding that they had another job offer of $40,000. At the outset of the negotiations, men and women showed no significant difference in what they hoped to make. But women anticipated blowback if they negotiated too hard. They assumed the hiring manager would judge them if they asked for more than $43,250. Men assumed they could negotiate up to $50,813 without pissing off the hiring manager. When the hiring manager then actually lowballed all the participants, women were quick to concede. They countered, asking for only $42,000. Men asked for more than $48,000. Those women knew what they were doing. They didn't ask for less because they thought they deserved less. They didn't ask for less because they thought their ask was competitive. They reported knowing that they were making big concessions, and they made those concessions because they were worried about the backlash they'd face. They knew they had to choose between getting what they wanted and being well-liked, and instead, they tried to split the difference. That's in the cases where women actually take on the negotiation. Simply anticipating that there will be backlash, women will often avoid negotiating altogether. Following the Sony Pictures leak, wherein hackers released confidential data, including emails that revealed that Jennifer Lawrence's American Hustle co-stars made more money than she did, Lawrence wrote a piece about how these perceptions and penalties had altered her approach to negotiations. I got mad at myself. I failed as a negotiator because I gave up early. I didn't want to keep fighting over millions of dollars that, frankly, due to two franchises, I don't need, Lawrence wrote. But if I'm honest with myself, I would be lying if I didn't say there was an element of wanting to be liked that influenced my decision to close the deal without a real fight. I didn't want to seem difficult or spoiled. And because the person on the other side of the negotiation knows all of this, they can use it to their advantage. When Caitlin Menza got the call saying she had landed a job at a women's magazine she long admired, she was over the moon. She was also ready to negotiate. As she jokingly told me, "I work in women's magazines, so I've read all the articles." But when she countered on salary, the recruiter balked. She said she'd have to loop back around with the hiring manager to ask her about the increase. "Are you sure you want me to?" she asked Caitlin. "You'll be starting off the role leaving a bad taste in their mouth. Don't you want them to like you?" Caitlin later recounted in a piece for Marie Claire. This recruiter knew that she had a powerful weapon in her back pocket. She played Caitlin's desire for more compensation against her desire to be well-liked, and her fear that she would be penalized for asking. Caitlin admits that she fell right into the trap. She immediately withdrew her counteroffer, begged the recruiter not to bring it up with her future manager, and accepted the original number. Goodbye, 5% increase. Hello, subtle sexism. Years later, Caitlin told that same hiring manager about the exchange, and that manager was horrified. "I did not know she wanted to ask for more. I would not have been mad or held it against her. And I am upset that anyone would use my influence to make a young journalist feel small and unworthy," the manager told me. The threat of jeopardizing Caitlin's likability wasn't even based on a likely outcome. It was simply playing on fear. So let's say you do negotiate and you do get the raise or the bonus or the extra 4 weeks of vacation time. By one measure, you've won. You've got what you asked for. But you might have unfairly lost something more amorphous in the process. What if the negotiation itself left such a bad taste in everyone's mouth that you can't overcome the perception that you are pushy or entitled? How real is that? How lasting is it? Do you then need to work to earn back your likability? Think about the long-term effects that those outcomes, being less likely to be hired, less likely to have others want to work with you, and less likely to have others want to spend time with you, can have on a woman's career. And so a woman must assess whether the potential benefits of negotiating, twice the likelihood of a higher salary, a better title, and better terms, is worth the risk of the potential consequences. A rescinded offer or alienating managers or colleagues who might be critical to her success in the future. W, the woman whose offer from Nazareth College was withdrawn after she attempted to negotiate, was just doing what professionals are counseled to do. She asked, "This is how I thought negotiating worked, how I learned to do it, and for that matter, how I think it should work," W wrote in a follow-up blog post. "You ask about a number of perks and maybe get some of them. I just thought there was no harm in asking." Among the unfair aspects of W's case was the lack of transparency around how and why the decision was made. Why didn't anyone spell it out, allowing her to weigh her options? Some of this is situational. A woman who is negotiating for a personal raise is less likely to face a penalty when she is higher up within an organization. And when women negotiate on behalf of a group, there is no penalty. Acting on behalf of others makes a woman seem, well, nice. But what that tells us is that a woman is not allowed to act in the service of herself. Feedback. Feedback and reviews are, by nature, subjective. But performance reviews of women employees tend to over-index on subjective feedback. Behavioral economist Paola Cecchi Demiglio's analysis of these reviews found that they are often riddled with the gender biases we've discussed, as well as confirmation bias. I knew she'd have a hard time completing the project on deadline. women are more likely to receive critical subjective feedback, meaning that for women, reviews and evaluations are often negative expressions of their manager's opinions of them, rather than positive expressions or useful evaluations of their skills and contributions. These biases are most noticeable and most problematic when viewed in contrast to evaluations of male peers. If Jill is indecisive but Mark is thoughtful, would you rather work with Jill or Mark? If Nadia is melodramatic but Dante is passionate, whom would you promote? Women are also less likely to receive constructively critical objective feedback, the type of insights on their work that is actionable and based on substance rather than style. The feedback women receive is often vague and not tied to outcomes. Even when they are praised, they don't receive pointed developmental feedback about what is necessary to make the next leap in their careers. So a woman may walk out of a performance review feeling great, but with no clear sense of what she's doing right or how she can use her existing skills to catapult herself to the next level. I have received only one performance review in my entire career. And since I just wrote a few pages on self-promotion, let me tell you, it was glowing. As someone who works hard, wants to be well-liked, and worries I'm not, I damn near floated out of the room following that review. But now that I look back on that experience, I realize no one told me how I could build upon what I'd already done or how I could improve. And because I just wanted the validation of being in everyone's good graces, I didn't think to ask. While we may need constructive critical feedback, there's often an assumption that women can't really handle it. It's awkward to give critical feedback to people in general, Lily Johnpohl, a behavioral scientist and diversity and inclusion strategist, explains. To mitigate the awkwardness, sometimes people will upwardly distort the feedback to make it sound less critical and to make delivering it less painful. Johnpohl suggests it's also possible that those tasked with giving feedback walk into those sessions with different goals, depending on the gender of the person they are reviewing. In Johnpohl's analysis, those goals are informed less by the assumption that women are more sensitive than men, and more by this idea that women don't have agency and require more handholding. While people want to be candid to both men and women, they find that people prioritize kindness goals more for women than for men, Johnpohl tells me. This same dynamic plays out with racial and ethnic minorities. That may sound like a good thing. I, too, like when people are nice to me. But if no one tells you what you're substantively doing wrong, you're bound to continue doing it over and over again. Finally, when women do get feedback, it tends to over-index on their communication style. Alexandra Wilkes Wilson, Senior Vice President of Consumer Strategy and Innovation at Allergan and co-founder of Gilt, Glam Squad, and Fitz, recalls being told early in her career that she used her hands too much when she spoke, and that if she insisted on using her hands, she ought to use them in a masculine way, like counting down her points. Ursula Burns, the former CEO of Xerox and the first Black female CEO of a Fortune 500 company, was told that her style of speaking was too fast and too casual. Tracy Chow, the software engineer and advocate for diversity in tech, who you'll recall was forced to do that silly mediation, was told by a manager that she should talk more about technical subjects in social settings so that her peers would take her more seriously. Not only is that feedback often biased and largely unhelpful, it takes up the time and space for discussing recommendations of what women can do to render measurable outcomes. Please don't help. You know those helper tasks that pop up in every office? The coworker who needs help with the coffee machine or filling out a vacation request? Agreeing to help with those tasks is seen as less optional for women than for men. In fact, some studies suggest that when a man is willing to pitch in on those altruistic tasks, it creates positive associations among his coworkers. You took out the trash? Gold star for you, Seth. Agreeing to those helper tasks doesn't give a woman the same boost because people expect that she'll be willing to do those things. And if she doesn't oblige, she actually gets a demerit. You didn't take out the trash, Jenna? You must be a monster. And even though women are expected to be helpful, they can't be too helpful. Studies show that women are perceived to be less task-oriented than their male peers. That's not because they can't focus enough to stay on task. It's because there is an expectation that they'll take a break on a selfish task to work on an unselfish task. Helping Gail reload the water cooler or holding Andre's clammy hand while he talks about how the girlfriend he's broken up with 3 times in the last 2 months is at it again. If you ask me, this type of work isn't really even that off task. It's necessary. Have you ever worked in a bougie professional office without filtered water? People would rather just dehydrate themselves than drink from the tap. Do you know how distracting it is for the team when Andre goes through a breakup and forces the entire pod to listen to Unbreak My Heart on a loop? The company loses hours of productivity, sometimes days. If a woman can take a quick break from budget reports to tend to Andre's broken heart and fragile ego, shouldn't we all applaud her for her service? Instead, her sensitivity to interpersonal drama is seen as a weakness rather than the public service it really is. This is my job. I'm not here to make friends. There's all the asking and self-promoting stuff that business books talk about, but can we just talk for a minute about the complexity of friendship in the workplace? Like, yes, you likely spend more time with your coworkers than your family, so it's natural that friendships develop. On the flip, you get paid to spend that time together. It's because that time is supposed to be spent in the service of something else. So what's the correct standard for what is socially mandatory at work? On one hand, I go to work primarily to get my work done. On the other, the only adult friends I have made are through work. But that chit-chatty in-between stuff, hearing about someone's obsession with Minecraft or the politics of their condo board, I really gotta be in the mood. But I know that to be well-liked, I need to go with it. And I know that my not always tactful honesty, dump him, is an acquired taste that requires more intimacy than you necessarily get by spending your lunch breaks with someone. Melissa, who works in fashion, was once told by a boss, "This office is a sorority and you're a bad pledge." At another job, a boss criticized Melissa for not sharing enough of her personal life with her and encouraged Melissa to come to her for dating advice. Doesn't that seem a little much? My friend Marisol, a television producer, loathes office small talk. "I don't want anyone to ask me what I did over the weekend, and I don't want to know what they did over the weekend," she says unapologetically. And yet I have watched as her office mates do what office mates do, recounting everything from day cruises to the Vanderpump Rules reunion. I know her well, and so I can see the amount of energy and self-control it takes for her to smile and pretend to nod along enthusiastically. Marisol believes that her work speaks for itself. She's good, she's fast, she's reliable. Her work, she argues, makes people like her. Unfortunately for Marisol and those like her, research shows that social capital, which you gain from all of that chit-chat and bowling alley outings and company picnics, is often more necessary to a manager's advancement than hard skills and execution of tasks. Opting out comes at a price. This is an especially big challenge for parents and caretakers who might not have the time to engage in office banter or dedicate to after-hours office extracurriculars. When you've got to leave work at 5 p.m. on the dot to make it to pickup, the workday feels as if it is marked by a starting pistol, and any interaction that is not efficient and productive can feel like a hurdle to executing everything on your to-do list before the imaginary end-of-the-day buzzer rings. Sometimes, you might even find yourself drifting into enjoying an office exchange about March Madness brackets, only to be interrupted mid-thought by visions of your disappointed kid sitting on the curb waiting for you, again. It's also especially difficult to participate in informal networking when you are a minority in your office. Because, you know, the queso stands alone. Ambition. On some level, the American public seems keenly aware of these biases. In 2015, asked by Pew Research to explain what's holding women back from top jobs, respondents identified biases such as women being held to higher standards and resistance to hiring and electing women as bigger barriers than, say, women not being good managers. The research also found that the public regarded men and women leaders in much the same way, with little distinction on intelligence or innovative ability. If anything, the findings showed that women have strategic advantages. In the eyes of the public, women are more likely to be honest, compassionate, and organized. When you ask which qualities are absolutely essential to leadership, men and women put honesty, intelligence, and decisiveness all at the top of their lists. But go a little further down those lists, and there are differences. Women are much more likely than men to include compassion among those qualities. They're also more likely to place a premium on innovation. And women, especially younger women, are more likely to say that ambition is important. Ambition. What a double-edged sword. Look at what all the research tells us about ambitious and successful women. They are punished by being viewed as less likable. Look at what history teaches us. To be a woman who is determined to succeed is to be judged, ostracized, scorned. It is often used to denote that a woman is ruthless, cold, or unstable. Yet ambition is a form of resilience. It is the motor that powers you through rejection, long nights, and pitch meetings where investors or studio executives or your higher-ups turn you down. A 2014 study by the Center for Talent Innovation found that Black women tend to be more ambitious than their white female peers. This doesn't surprise me at all. If the path to leadership narrows for women generally, and narrows even more extremely for Black women, then of course a Black woman needs an extra strong motor to push herself through. When you have been historically discounted, if you run the risk of being invisible, of course you have to declare louder and bolder, "I want this and I deserve this." Black women do not have the luxury of being ambivalent or modest about their ambition. Black women on the path to a leadership position are more likely to view a leadership role as enabling them to flourish and be empowered and empower others. They are also more likely to identify the ability to shape the direction of their field or profession and the ability to exert influence on other powerful people as critical elements of being in power. Of course, if they have been at the mercy of organizational leaders who do not share their life experience, they want to clear the way for others. The irony is not lost on me that while women are judged for the supposedly ruthless, selfish fact of ambition, they identify helping others as a prime motivator for seeking power. Sounds wildly selfish to me. You know how in Super Mario Brothers, Mario, with the help of a Starman, will become temporarily invincible? You know how it supercharges him through every hurdle along the way, allowing him to jump higher, to blast through noxious critters unscathed? That, to me, is the potential power of ambition. No wonder it evokes such disdain. Without ambition, no woman would ever be propelled to take on the challenges of the firsts and the greats. Without a woman's ambition, there is no Oprah or Ava DuVernay, no Melody Hobson or Geisha Williams. Even the most altruistic, civic, and philanthropic leaders have to have ambitions for their cause, if not ambitions for themselves. It doesn't surprise me that women believe that ambition is critical to being a leader. Because ambition is the thing that keeps you saying yes when everyone keeps telling you no. All of these professional necessities, getting hired, self-promotion, negotiating, receiving feedback, developing social capital, and cultivating ambition are critical for success. And yet they are all fraught with their own complexities. But let's say you survive the gauntlet. You still have to get through the biggest obstacle, the power grab.